combination of darker mornings, cumulative sleep deprivation, and looming term papers tends to gradually erode punctuality. What I'd like to do today is lay out the central themes of this final section on ideology and culture, the problem of micro-foundations for a theory of ideology, to do so in my more efficient mode in sort of 40, 45 minutes, and then have an hour for a freewheeling general discussion of the themes of this ideology and culture section. What I'd like to do is to try to see what happens if we just do that in the large group without breaking down, but if in the end it seems that only a few people are talking, we might then decide to break down into smaller groups. So I'm going to try to lay out this micro-foundation problem pretty succinctly. I'll begin by explaining the problem, what it means to look for micro-foundations for a theory of ideology, and why this is important. We've discussed this a little bit here and there in the course of the semester, the relationship between micro and macro levels of analysis. This is one of these themes in social theory that gets thrown around a lot, often I think in ways that simply adds to the confusion of people's thinking about this. Many people feel like you have to make a choice between a micro or a macro analysis, that if you take seriously micro analysis, it means that somehow or other you're discrediting the legitimacy of macro analysis. Or on the other hand, if you really want to study macro problems, then you have to neglect micro. I would like to argue that a serious sociological theory of any sort, and in particular one that has as its core an emancipatory agenda, has to be as symmetrically as possible micro and macro. Not regard these as in tension or in trade-off, but rather to figure out the ways in which they both figure in our explanations. For some problems, for some questions you're trying to answer, the analysis will necessarily be more focused on one or the other, but that's because of the problem at hand, not because of some intrinsic feature of social analysis that requires that you always invoke the micro rather than the macro, or the macro rather than the micro. I prefer the term I use to describe the micro in these contexts is micro foundation. The word foundation is a tricky one. It sometimes seems to imply some kind of primacy. You know, that is, if you're using an architectural metaphor, buildings are constructed on top of foundations. And it seems like you begin with the foundation and then you build the building. But when you think about it, of course, you can have extraordinary variation in the kinds of buildings that you might actually build on the same foundation. So foundations imply some kind of constraint on what sort of building you have. But it's not that knowing the foundation, you know the building. So even that metaphor doesn't imply that knowing the foundation tells you everything. It tells you something. The word micro-foundation means that every building does have a foundation. It has to be built on something. And that to understand the building, you have to understand, among other things, those foundations. Any metaphor is misleading as well as helpful. I haven't found an alternative metaphor that works better. So I do think that macro explanations require micro foundations. I don't believe that macro explanations can be reduced to their micro foundations. But they're incomplete without them. And sometimes you discover you've made errors in your macro thinking because you've misunderstood the way in which they're connected to micro processes. Well, at the core of any micro theory is what in sociology is referred to as a theory of action or a model of action. I've used the word practices to describe the particular kind of theory of action that I like to work with. The more general notion is a model of action. this is on page one of the notes, if you have your notes. So here, I would like to lay out what I think of as the general components that any theory of action must have. Any theory that attempts to explain why people act the way they do needs to have these elements. Which of these elements become the most important? Which ones you emphasize, again, would depend upon the particular purposes that you have. Some particular theoretical traditions are going to emphasize one or another. But I think, in fact, any complete and comprehensive account of individual action that will be helpful in understanding macro problems will have all of these elements in one way or another. So this is a kind of menu to describe what you need to learn about individual action to fully understand how it fits into macro problems. Okay, so first, we can divide individual action into two clusters of components. A cluster of components that are internal to the acting subject, and a cluster of components that define their circumstances. So To begin with, I'm making a cut into a theory of action between internal processes, which we can call subjective, and objective process. I'm using the term objective to mean in the environment or in the context of the acting person. Just a note on these terms, subjective and objective. This is another example of rhetoric that's used in sociology and in social theory that's fraught with problems. I believe you can have an objective account of subjectivity. That's using the word objective in a different sense from what I'm using here. You can have a subjective account of objectivity. That is, you can have an account of what's in the environment that is strictly from the point of view, the perceptions of the actors. That would be a subjective account of the objective conditions. I'm using objective and subjective in this context to imply the internal states of actors, that is, parts of the action that are rooted in mechanisms inside of the person, and objective to mean parts of the action that are embedded in their contexts. Okay, so first let's begin with how do we, what's the menu internal to the person? First, people have preferences. This is what people want. This includes values, norms, ideas, beliefs. People have I'm being too vague here. It includes values which define what sorts of things people believe are good, but also wants and needs. These need not be viewed as fixed. A lot of preferences can change and be very fuzzy. A lot of individual action involves people discovering what they want, not just acting on what they want. There's no reason to assume that people know their own preferences, in the sense that you have a complicated set of things you want and desire. But you may be very unclear about how they fit together and which is most important, or even what the real substance of a preference is. But one thing that we need in a theory of action is an account of what people want. Second thing is information. These are perceptions about what exists, what options are available. When we're describing it as an internal state, we're not talking about what options are actually available. We're talking about what people believe are of the options that are available. So the internal state is people's perceptions of what exists and what's possible for them to do. So you have preferences and you have a set of alternative things you could do. The third component of the subjective state of actors are theories. These are conceptions of what will be the consequences of given choices for your preferences, given your information. Now, sometimes these theories are extremely pragmatic, experiential theories that are simply generalizations from what you've learned in the past. So to take the paradigmatic example, which I think I've used a couple of times. You go into a grocery store because of a craving for chocolate. You go to the chocolate counter and you pick out your favorite chocolate and you purchase it. Right now, that seems like a pretty simple explanation. I don't think there's any social theory which would say, no, that's not the explanation for why this particular act took place. There may be lots of other things to explain why a person engaged in that set of practices, but it's a pretty ordinary experience to have a desire, which takes the form then of a preference. You're aware of your desire, and you have information about how you can solve it, what's available. You have information about what's available, and you have a theory then. The theory is, based on past practice, that if you buy that chocolate bar, unwrap it, and eat it, it will satisfy your craving. That's a very simple theory that you have. A lot of course, choices and actions involve much more complicated theories, because the nature of the effects of your choices are less determined, less transparent.
A theory then is a belief.
What?
Theory is a belief.
It's a belief about... all of these things can be called beliefs. Information is also beliefs. Values are beliefs. Beliefs about what's good. Theories are beliefs about the consequences of action. How the world works. So information is just saying what's available. Theories are about how it works. What are the consequences of choosing X as opposed to Y? So every trivial action involves a theory, because you are making a choice on the basis of its anticipated effects, right? What it means to have an intention to do something is to make a choice on the basis of an anticipated effect. But anticipation of an effect implies a theory of what will happen if you make this choice. Often, these are pretty trivial theories. You know, that buying a chocolate bar and expecting it to satisfy your cravings is a very simple theory. But it could turn out to be wrong in any particular instance. You know, a particular chocolate bar could turn out to be dried out and crusty and just disgusting to eat. Or something could have changed in your internal state from the last time you had a chocolate and discover that it no longer satisfies your craving. I mean, a little personal anecdote. My wife's first indication that she was pregnant with our daughter was that she drank a cup of coffee and it tasted terrible. And that's apparently not an uncommon consequence of whatever hormonal changes are in play with pregnancy, that it changes your taste buds and has effects on certain things that you always used to like. They don't longer taste the same. Well, that's an example where her theory was incomplete. She had a theory that was a pure inductive theory based on past experience where coffee would have this effect. She hadn't taken into account an important causal component of that relationship, which was hormones that affect one's taste buds. Most people don't think about that when they have their theories of what they like to eat. And she discovered something wrong. She initially blamed me for bad coffee, but that was joyfully discovered not to be the source of the problem. Okay, preferences, information, theories. The next two are more subtle. And a lot of action actually applies on the next one in particular. There's a lot of action in this next one. It's what I would call mental capacities. This includes conventional things like cognitive abilities and skills, but there are also much more subtle aspects of mental capacities. Problem-solving ability. Creativity. Imaginative ability, empathic skills, flexibility, intuitive abilities, wisdom. There's a lot of mental capacity that people have. It develops over time. Adults have certain kinds of mental capacities that children don't have. That's not reducible simply to them having more information and better theories of the world. They also have a different way of processing information. and a different way of correcting their theories. They have learning capacities. Problem-solving capacities and creative capacities are particularly important kinds of mental capacities. Some kinds of social settings foster those, others impede them. One of the ways in which micro and macro interact is in the formation of capacities, internal capacities, not just external resources. So mental capacities, I think, are an important part of subjectivity. Part of what happens in education, including political education by social movements, is enhancing people's mental capacities, not just improving their information and their theories. People get trained in how to think, not just in the specific content of what they're thinking, which would be the information and the theories that they have. And finally, there is this vast and elusive domain that we could call the non-conscious psychic processes, underlying drives, the unconscious, personality, character, habits, dispositions, all of those sorts of things. These are also part of the subjective reality of people. So preferences, information, and theories, and even mental capacities won't tell you what people are going to do, because in some contexts, what they will do will be driven by, for example, fears that are embedded in their unconscious structures, or anger. There's lots of emotional drives that impinge on choice and action, which I don't think can be properly represented in the form of changes of preferences, information theories, or capacities. Sometimes it's a little hard to distinguish mental capacities from unconscious processes. They're obviously connected in some way. And I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not purporting to give you a nuanced psychological account of how these different components fit together. But in some way or other, those five elements need to be included in an account of the internal states of actors that come into play in the explanation of their actions. Yeah?
I'm trying to think of where motivations fall into it. Is it that preferences guide the motivations to act?
Motivations are partially driven by unconscious processes, so motivations are fueled by emotions and drives and so on, right? So there's the word motivation includes a notion of affect and intensity, and it includes a notion of preference, what you want, right? So it's a motivation is a way of talking about a cluster, a subset of these. Motivations do not include information and theories. That is, motivations explain action in combination with the information that a person has and their theories of consequences. But the word motivation itself, I think, invokes unconscious aspects of human action along with preferences. I think that word straddles A and D and E of these. Yeah?
How would you account for irrational behavior?
So irrational behavior has to do with the way in which E, unconscious mental processes, and D, mental capacities, bear on A, preferences, right? So everybody has irrational tendencies that are due to various kinds of psychological processes, which are usually unconscious in the sense that the process which most people, when they're acting irrationally, don't say, aha, I'm acting irrationally. It's that most of the time what's happening is that there's something which is interfering with their being able to make choices that would have the consequences that they want. They're being driven by some distortion of some sort or another.
So are you saying their mental capacities are hampered to function properly?
Yeah, so, but it can also be the case that certain kinds of irrationality are desirable. That it's not quite right to have as a norm, a kind of ideal type, the cold, rational calculation of consequences with information and theories given our preferences. you know, that sort of rational actor model of the economist as being some kind of normative model that we aspire to, and everything else is a distortion and degradation of that. It may be, for example, that optimism, which can be irrational in the sense of it implying an over expectation of positive results, to be optimistic in a bleak world is to have too much hope given the realistic probabilities. But it may be that optimism is a much better way for people to live, that they're actually able to cope with setbacks and failures if they're optimistic, even if it's not rational to be optimistic. Rational in the sense of it reflecting an accurate perception of the probabilities of good things happening. It may be good for people to be optimistic. They're likely to be more adaptive, more able to cope, to try again and get and achieve something in life that is better than it would be if they were pessimists, for example. That doesn't make optimism rational in the sense that it accurately portrays the probabilities of good things happening. So I don't want to imply that rationality is always good and irrationality is bad. I think it's just a more complicated problem than that. Okay, so these are the,
In general, in sociology, I almost never see, most of those elements explaining action, including, especially unconscious abilities or, how do you actually, as a sociologist, you look for those elements?
Well, the first three are certainly present. Bourdieu emphasizes E. Habitus is very substantially about the formation of unconscious dispositions and habits. That his Bourdieu's emphasis on how our orientation towards social action is embodied physically in ourselves, so that, and he means embodied in the very strong sense of in our bodies as ingrained habits. When he is, and he uses sports analogies to explain that. So a good example, if you're a skilled athlete and you're on the field of action, you're not constantly thinking consciously about exactly what you're going to do at every moment, right? So you do constantly monitor and think about the game, but when it comes to going for the ball and knowing how to switch from your right foot to your left foot to get around a defender if you're playing soccer, you know, the fancy, quick juggling that goes on, it's not that at each of those moves it's passing through a conscious, strategic, cost-benefit information and theories mechanism. No, it's embodied. You have a feel for the game. It's been inscribed in habits of action and reaction where the stimulus of the environment leads directly to action because of this embodied character. That, when you have that feel for the game in a sporting context, we just call it skill. But in a social context, it's equally a question of having a feel for the game. You all have a pretty good feel for the game of academic life. You're all very good at it. You've been at it for a long time. And you know what it means to listen to an argument, to hear a blowhard professor versus, I hope, a serious, analytically interesting professor, talk. You know when to tune out, when not to. You know how to ask a question. You know the rules of civility. That is, there are certain just manners and stuff in this that govern our interactions, but there are much more subtle things that govern our interactions here. And they're embodied, they've become unconscious. They're part of this E. And Bourdieu emphasizes that. And if you find yourself in situations where you don't have the right kinds of habits and dispositions for the social context, it's very awkward. It can be excruciatingly painful. Something that as social animals, those kinds of awkward situations are really tough. And those of you, particularly those of you who have traveled, are the students who are here who aren't from, didn't grow up here, you've encountered situations where you don't know the rules of the game. And it's not just a question of information and theories. It's much more subtle than that. There's a very nice study, I don't think I've mentioned this study, a wonderful study of the United Nations, which is a great setting for this, right? Because in the UN, people come from all over the world, including, given that we have 180 or so countries now, from countries that have really only very recently entered the kind of global arena. And there was a study of big cocktail parties where the normative distance at which you talk to somebody varies a lot cross-culturally. So some places, some countries you talk at this distance, others you talk not exactly nose to nose, but you know, much closer. And there's a sense of when you're invading somebody's personal space. Now, if you had an overhead camera and you tracked how people move, what you'd see what happens when a nose-to-nose person comes to talk to a keep-your-distance person. Well, the keep-your-distance person is constantly backing up and the nose-to-nose person is constantly moving forward. So you could identify the cultures, in broad sense, that people come from by looking at how conversations physically moved in that space. That's an example of something embodied. So I think in sociology, E is certainly, the first three are taken. Skill, mental capacity, is often less discussed. Hans Joas is a German sociologist, a student of Klaus Hoffe, and thus of Habermas. He was a kind of grandchild of Habermas, so to speak. He has written some very interesting things on creativity of action. Creativity as a sociological idea. And in which he sees it as a skill, essentially, that gets cultivated or hampered, but is absolutely central to understanding social contexts and social action. That people don't... Creative action is different from simply instrumental action, because creativity involves redefinitions of the nature of context often.
Can you say the name one more time? I'm sorry.
Joas. J-O-A-S. Hans. He has a book called The Creativity of Action. I believe that's the title.
Thank you.
He's also heavily influenced by Thomas Dewey, the pragmatist American philosopher, whose center piece of his concept of action is problem solving. Again, as a little digression, I think from the point of view of critical theory, kind of emancipatory, progressive social science, the notion of problem solving or pragmatic action is really something that should be central. It's very closely tied to the notion of practice as transformation. You know, a production process that transforms an input into a product, whether that the input be social relations through political practice or subjectivity. A lot of what's going on there is problem solving, to figure out how to do the transformation in a way that produces the kind of effect that you want. Problem solving action is central to a lot of contemporary left democratic theory. What deliberative democracy is all about is problem solving, where the nature of the problem has to be figured out in order for it to be solved. And problem solving as a way of thinking of the skill of problem solving is quite different from simply having a set of fixed ends and figuring out what the best means to those ends are. Problem solving typically involves continually redefining the ends as you would develop your means to solve it. It's a process of deliberation and discovery rather than simply instrumental application of a set of instruments to a given end. So problem solving is a skill. There is another question here, Daniel.
I wanted to follow up on Ife, right? Ife's question about explaining irrationality, because when I mean, that question assumes that that you can actually identify irrational action when you see it, right? Or that it's somewhere out there. I
I think that's it's hard to do. And we all know that we cannot subjectively say, like, you know, given all of this information, because a person, an individual, like you also say, may not have the complete information, may not have about different outcomes, about different how different alternatives lead to different outcomes. But what would be interesting, I'm not sure how you look at that, is so what it comes down to is the rationality of beliefs, right? Because if you say that optimism, for so in saying that something is over-optimistic implies that you have a certain understanding of what would not be optimistic, and where and that makes it very complex.
So this issue of rationality and irrationality is a very interesting and deep problem. If you want, just to give you some more bibliographic references, to me the two best, there's a pair of books on rationality and irrationality, which I think are extraordinary, wonderful books to read. They're clear, easy, completely interesting, and they really help to clarify a whole range of problems around this issue. They're both by Jan Elster. They're books he wrote a long time ago. The one is called Ulysses and the Sirens, and the other is called Sour Grapes. Ulysses and the Sirens is a book about rationality, and Sour Grapes is a book about irrationality. And as a pair, they're both just incredibly interesting to read. You'll enjoy them. So there's no, this isn't a painful task to read. Very insightful book. So the model, the Ulysses and the Sirens, is a book about the distinctive character of human rationality. And one of the distinctive aspects of human rationality is what could be called meta-rationality. That is, we know that we don't always act rationally. So we can be rational about our own rationality. The Ulysses and the Sirens story, which is, maybe not familiar to everyone. The idea was Ulysses was the captain of a ship. They had to go in a channel where he knew he would face the sirens, these mermaid-like, I think, mythical creatures that would lure him to his death and the destruction of his ship. He knew in advance that he would act self-destructively when he heard the song of the sirens. And he knew that when he heard the song of the sirens, he would not be able to resist it. So he knew that he would have weakness of will against the temptation of following the song of the sirens. So what does he tell his crew? He says, okay, as we approach this place, I want you to tie my hands behind me to a mast. So he gets tied to the ship's mast. And I order you not to untie my hands, even though I will order you to untie them. Right, so he tells them ahead of times, I want you to tie my hands. I want you to bind my choices so that I can't make the destructive choice later. And thus the ship is able to pass through the sirens, which it otherwise wouldn't be. Now, that's a fantastic parable for this point because it clearly does give you a way of distinguishing rationality from irrationality. That is, the rationality criterion is knowing all this ahead of time, what will you do to prevent yourself from acting in a destructive way later? And the fact that Ulysses knew that he was going to act irrationally enabled him to constrain his choices in the future. This has been a paradigm for all sorts of things that people do. You know, if you are trying to lose weight, one of the things you do is to avoid having cream puffs in your house, right? So it's harder to resist the cream puff when it's there in front of you than it is to just not buy it in the first place. So removing things from your environment that provide temptation, that expression, temptation, is a word that suggests that we know when we can be irrational. The sour grapes story is the fox and the grapes parable, where the fox lusts after these grapes. They're too high, the fox gets frustrated and decides that the grapes were sour. Wouldn't like them anyway. Well, that's irrational in the sense that it's a false claim about the world. that the grapes are sour simply because you can't have them. That's what's called adaptive preference formation. It's your preferences, or adaptive belief formation in this case, that your beliefs about the world adapt to the realities of what you can get. Well, that's a form of irrationality in the second book.
Yeah, what the problem for me arises is that, so assuming that rationality is something subjective, right? So you have to look at an individual in the context in which that individual is operating to judge whether or not some decision or choice was rational or not, right? And then you could say irrational behavior occurs when your unconscious or non-conscious psychic, or when there are effects or emotions at play, which go against the information that you have, your theories and beliefs about,
how or which block happens. You from getting the right information. That is,
yeah,
you know, the that could be equally.
So that would be one type of irrationality, and then another would be that the way that, so the theories that you have formulated on the basis of past experiences do not seem to make sense given those past experiences, and that type of irrationality, I think it's very hard to judge, right? So then you would say that would, for instance, be over optimistic or something else. So the belief about the relation about the consequence of certain actions or
you know, I think in a way you're making this more complicated than needed in the following sense. It just means that we need a bigger repertoire of ways of describing context. We can say that given the theories and information that a person had, they acted perfectly rational, even though it led to their destruction. But they had faulty information. So that would be a case where we would say their cognitive processes were rational, but there was some process which gave them bad information, which led them to do something that was self-destructive. Now, if the reason they had bad information, however, was their refusal to listen to a source of good information because it was a black person who was saying it, and they never believe a black person, you know, or whatever, you know, you can have various accounts for why they have bad information, you could then diagnose the action as actually irrational because of the formation of one of its key subjective components was driven by an irrational process. That is a process which rejects good information in favor of bad information. If a person has a bad theory about how the world works, but they act perfectly rationally given the bad theory, then it depends on why they have a bad theory. And so the diagnosis of the non-rationality or the irrationality requires really interrogating the process of the formation of beliefs rather than simply the action given the beliefs. It also can be the case that a person has perfectly legitimate good theories, they have the best theories around, nothing wrong with their views about the consequences of choice, they have good information. Their preferences in terms of what they say they want, their conscious preferences, are also coherent. But they are driven by emotional urges which subvert their ability to use their information and their theories to realize their preferences. So they're constantly subverting themselves. That would be another way that an irrational process could occur. So there may be cases where you can't make a judgment, but that I don't think that makes the analytical space an incoherent one. Yeah.
By rationality, all you meaning is given all the information, you act in your interest for rationality, and given the information, you act not in your interest for irrationality. Is that?
Well, I didn't invoke the term interests yet. I talked about preferences. So the preferences themselves may be formed in such a way as to be self-destructive. That is, the preferences may act against your interests. So there can be irrationality in the character of your preferences. An addict, for example, has preferences for a drug which can be self-destructive. They can recognize that their preferences are self-destructive, as Ulysses and the Sirens, so to speak, but they fail to tie their hands to the mast, so to speak. So given their information theories and preferences, it's perfectly rational for a heroin addict to shoot up. It is indeed. They've got good information about where to get the heroin and good theories about what the consequences of doing it for the satisfaction of their craving. But they may or may not recognize that it's self-destructive. So we can, the analyst can say, yes, it's perfectly rational for a heroin addict to use heroin, but make the claim that it will destroy the person in time. And then that self-destructive act, do we want to say that's irrational to be self-destructive? Well, then, you know, that gets into a judgment about the nature of preferences and interests. Short-term, long-term, that's not so clear. It's not so clear. It's, you know, if you're in a world where there's the job opportunities are not so great, life seems pretty miserable, it's totally obvious that it's irrational to be an addict. You know, given that space, irrational in the sense that the preferences that are driven by the addiction are irrational. They cease to be under the control of the agent.
I mean, it's rational to not believe in irrationality, right? I mean,
to not believe in irrationality.
I mean, rational belief and irrational belief is a philosophical distinction. It's rational to not recognize irrational belief. I mean, the word in Western thought was made up by Aristotle, right?
Yeah, but I think it's a human universal that people make the distinction. Everybody recognizes in every culture that there are people who are doing things that are stupid and not thought out with respect to what they're trying to achieve, and that's why they get corrected. You know, just in pragmatic terms. I'm not talking lofty terms about ultimate meaning or anything. I'm just talking about somebody saying, if you want to get the coconuts, this is the way you climb the tree, and somebody saying, no, it's not, I'll do it this way, and they fall and break their neck, and you say, see, you were wrong, and they try it again the wrong way. I mean, then you, in that culture, they would say, that is not a rational way to get coconuts, or whatever. That is, it's not an appropriate and rational means for the end being specified, and there's some reason why you refuse to acknowledge that. I mean, not you, the bad coconut. So I don't think, the terms rationality may be recent in human history. I don't think the basic notion that our basic cognitive capacities have been more or less in place for the last 40,000 years as far as evolutionary biologists know, and those cognitive capacities have been used to solve problems right from the start. Technical change in Neolithic times was the result of people applying their intelligence to solve problems. And everywhere people recognized the difference between doing that well and doing it badly. So I don't think it's an arbitrary idea.
That's why I was trying to pin down the definition of rationality. If it's just wrong action.
Well, that would be one. That's the simple form of irrationality, is persistent. That is, the simple fact of wrong action doesn't show that the cognitive process was irrational, because you could have been operating under bad theories and bad information. Right. So the fact that you fail in some goal doesn't mean that it's irrational the way you went about it. But the persistence in failure, in the light of better information, would indicate that there's something irrational in the way you're proceeding. And I think that's a fairly universal human capacity. The capacity for that kind of rationality, and thus our capacity to learn, is a pretty, I think, is a general human capacity. Let me go on with the account here. All right, so those are the five elements that are, in different ways, need to be juggled and integrated in an account of the internal conditions of action. There are three elements in the external conditions of action. First are the resources of various sorts that are at the disposal of actors, which define their capacity to act. And these resources are organized relationally. That's a key aspect of social action, is that the resources we have available are interdependent with our social relations with others. That's the difference between the Robinson Crusoe story. You know, Robinson Crusoe lands on the island. The only resources he has available initially are resources which he makes or that he controls himself. He's by himself, and his ability to survive depends upon his ability to mobilize his mental capacities, his problem-solving abilities, to build a shelter and so on. But once his man Friday arrives, he then has another resource, which then depends upon social relations. It's a relational resource, not just a atomized resource. So there's resources in the environment. Second, there's a causal environment of choosing. So people make choices and act, and that takes place in a causal environment that's external to the chooser. So this includes obvious things like the feasible set of choices, of possible choices. That's something in your environment. The feasible set of what you can actually do is different from the informational condition, which is your perception about what you can do. But there is obviously a connection. The feasible set of what you can actually do defines what you can actually do. Your perceptions may be a subset of that, or your perceptions may include things that you can't actually do. You know, people can have they can think they can do certain things that they can't. They try it and they discover they can't do it. But there are also there are other aspects of the causal environment of choosing which are much more subtle and I think social, that involve social interactions. I give just one little illustration in my notes. Problem-solving capacity is an internal mental state capacity. Some people are really good at problem-solving, other people are not so good at problem-solving. You know, some people have just better skills at being able to diagnose a situation and figure out what to do to solve whatever problem they have. But we have this expression, two heads are better than one. Now that's actually a very deep idea, that two heads are better than one. What it implies is that your problem-solving capacity depends upon who you're talking to, not just who you are. That it's often the case that a dialogue over a problem creates synergetic effects, so that if one person by themselves is completely stumped, either of two people by themselves are completely stumped, but the act of communication and deliberation between people suddenly enhances their respective problem-solving capacities. That means that problem-solving capacity is as much a function of the interactive space in which people are acting as their internal states. It's a fully social phenomenon, your ability to solve problems, because your ability to understand what the problem is comes through communication. Purely internal communication isn't as good in some contexts. In some contexts it is. And that's one way to think about this. Andrew Sayer is I don't know if I've mentioned him. He has another wonderful book should be on your list of things to read sometime, called The Moral Economy of Class. He has a wonderful discussion of what he calls internal dialogues, that is, the conversations people have with themselves around various kinds of problems, and how important that is for the development of one's own preferences. Very interesting idea. It's in the context of a critique of Bourdieu, actually. Andrew Sayer adopts a lot of Bourdieu's arguments, but he adds this notion of internal dialogue, which then another language for talking about that is reflexivity. It's the way in which you're reflecting upon your own actions through internal dialogue. So there's this very interesting question about the relationship between internal dialogue, which we all have. You know, it's an everyday experience, talking to yourself about things, thinking through things. sometimes the internal dialogues have a moral character, because you're thinking through moral dilemmas, questions about what you should do, what your obligations are. So there's an interesting problem of the relationship between internal dialogue and external dialogue, and how these interplay. So it's a common experience, and when you all become, or many of you become professors, you'll have this experience, having an external dialogue with students on some issue, theoretical issue, in which there's some very, you know, sharp disagreements, and it seems like people have set positions where they are not going to budge an inch, and they're defending their views, and then people go off, and they think about it. That means they have an internal dialogue. And in the privacy of their own head, so to speak, they can work through issues and change their mind. That's a fantastic expression, changing your mind. So that the next time you have the dialogue, their positions have changed. Whereas they wouldn't change them in the dialogue because of the public character of it and the norms about winning and losing an argument, which in some contexts make people very stubborn in public, but then they change over time. So that's the causal environment of making your choices. If you're in an environment where you're making your choices with a lot of discussion with other people, the choices are likely to be different than the causal environment in which you're making your choices as an isolated, separate person. And finally, the third aspect of the objective context of choice is the causal environment of the effects of your actions. Not the causal environment in which you make your action, but the causal environment of the effects of your action. This is what game theorists is all about. I mean, game theory is all about how the aggregate effects of individuals making choices lead to consequences which are different from the anticipated effects of people making those choices. So people, the choice that you make is based on your theory, given the information and these other things. So the choice you make is based on an account of your anticipated consequences, but everybody's making choices in a social context of that character. And the actual aggregated consequences can be, as we know from things like collective action problems, very different from the anticipated choices. Much of the action of the relationship between micro and macro centers on these three external elements, which I would argue are irreducible to the micro properties of the people acting within those settings, which really these three elements all in different ways hinge around the nature of the relations among people, and in some contexts, the relations among the relations. So as you move from micro to macro, what you are doing is moving from relations among people to relations among people to relations among the relations. We give names to these steps in a micro to macro so that we don't have to keep adding endless relations among relations. So if you have relations among people, the relations among people we call organizations. So an organization is a relation among relations. And we often think of relations among organizations as systems. You know, so the simplest kind of micro to macro is that you have persons, you have interpersonal relations, that's relations among persons. You have organizations, which are relations among the relations among persons, and then you have relations among those organizations, which we would call a system. That's the very kind of simplest micro, meso, organizations being meso, and macro being the relations among those meso organizations. Micro-sociology is not actually the study of persons, in my view, but rather the study of the relations among persons. Micro-sociology is interpersonal sociology. When you're just studying individual persons as such, then you're doing social psychology. It's not sociology anymore. That is, the smallest unit of sociology is relations among persons. That's the most micro unit that remains social. in its character. There's some discussion of this in my class consciousness theoretical chapter in Class Counts, which I think that was assigned for one of these ideology and culture sessions. I mean, I have this general view, which is that all social science and psychology, it's all relational. It's relations all the way down. You know, just it's always relational. What a psychologist is doing is studying the relations among the components of a psychological system. When you study any given component, what does it mean to study a given component of something? You study its internal relations, the relations among whatever it is that make it up. So it's relations all the way down. If you think about biology, you know, you can study whole organisms, you can study the relations among their organs. What does it mean to study the heart as a particular organ in a creature? Well, you're studying how it works, which means studying the relations among its internal components within the heart. If you want to study how a particular vessel works, what does that mean? You study how the components that make up an artery work. You know, so all the way down, as you go from more macro to more micro, what you're studying is the relations among the, whatever the components are of that particular causal environment. The monadic person, the separate biological entities that we call individual persons, as an object of study, means that you're studying how the internal components of that person works, which in the psychological context would be how cognitive processes and affective processes interact, and the different aspects of cognitive processes. The first sociological study, then, is the relationship among persons, and social psychology is the bridging discipline, which studies how the relations within persons interact with the relations between persons. And that's what this little model of action is all about. The first five components are the relations within persons. These are elements interior to a person. And when you study action, you're studying how these interact with these three social relational components. A, B, C, and D, and E are subjectivity, and A, B, and C in this list are the specific parts of the of subjectivity that constitute the ideological processes of subjectivity. That is, the processes that are implicated in consciousness. All right. Well, I said I was going to... Of course, we did have discussion along the way, so it's, I shouldn't feel like I... I don't want... I'm not going to go through all of Jan Elster's arguments and analysis. Let's go to section... If you have your notes, go to 2.3. I'm going to skip this for the moment, anyway. A lot of this... introductory stuff. I think we've ended up talking about it one way or another anyway. What I do want to do is, I want to look at this little chart and explain what's going on with each of these. So what Elster is trying to do here is the following. When you study ideologies, the content of ideologies, that is, when you, if you want to look at a revolutionary ideology, you can specify what the theories are that are embodied in it, what the nature of the values that it expresses are, and what kinds of information it requires in order for it to function. So, you know, you can look at the content of the ideas that people have who are socialists, who are reactionaries, who are liberals, whatever. In any context, you can do an inventory of the beliefs that they hold, the subjective parts of their mental life that bear on their preferences, information, and theories. And what Elster is arguing is that these mental components have psychological foundations that can be understood through cognitive psychology especially, rather than simply having a content which has been instilled in a person. So here, just to give you a sharp contrast here. One way of thinking about answering the question, why do people hold the ideologies they hold? One answer is, they've had it drummed into their heads. So people hold this set of beliefs because that's what they've been told. And all of these beliefs are simply learned in a kind of pedagogical way. So the vision is that people are sort of passive agents, and they are receptacles for ideas which are pumped into them. And once they're pumped into them, they hold them in their heads, and they constitute their belief structures, which we can call their ideologies. They've been formed on as social subjects just through the messages which they receive. Now, in that view implies an extremely thin view of the cognitive processes that go on inside of people. Right? It doesn't have any. There's no active problem solving, creative action, thinking, reflexivity, internal questioning, wishful thinking, cognitive dissonance. I mean, none of those mechanisms are in play. What Elster argues is that, of course, people get messages. People hear all sorts of things. They're told many things. Some of these beliefs are stable. Some are unstable. Some get integrated firmly into a psychological structure. Others are precarious and are easily dislodged. And the question is, how do we understand this whole terrain of the internal processing of ideas that then become part of our subjective orientations? And for that, he argues, we need an account of the cognitive social psychology of belief formation. Such an account will also help us understand what aspects of people's beliefs we can change through argument, and what kinds will be very difficult to change. That in order to change certain kinds of beliefs, you'd have to change, for some people, you'd have to change much more about their social environment in order for the belief change to occur. He then builds an account around two components about beliefs, what he would call motivational and cognitive components. That is, components that are driven by our emotional or affective aspects of our psychology, and the parts that are driven by our thinking. And he uses this to say we can explain the motivational and cognitive aspects of our beliefs by motivational and cognitive processes. So the vertical, the two rows, are the explanatory principles, motivational explanations and cognitive explanations. And what are being explained are the motivational aspects of our beliefs and the cognitive aspects of our beliefs. And then he has these four categories: wishful thinking, adaptive preferences, mental bookkeeping, and what he calls the availability heuristic. The availability heuristic is a cognitive explanation of a cognitive aspect of our beliefs. Adaptive preferences are a motivational explanation of a motivational aspect of our beliefs. So the adaptive preferences is the sour grapes story. Your preferences, which are part of your motivations, what you want, are shaped by motivational processes. Frustration over achieving certain things affects what you end up wanting. Adaptive preference formation. The sour grape story is the paradigm. Wishful thinking involves a motivational explanation of a cognitive product, what you believe is possible in the world. Good argument can be made, I think, that the communist movement throughout its history has been driven by, in part, a very powerful kind of wishful thinking. That is, because of the desire for a better and more humane and just world, people came to believe that such a world was possible. Sometimes in their own lifetimes, you know, the messianic belief that certain possibilities, where there's a will, there's a way. If only we didn't have opportunistic leaders, we would be able to win the battle. This kind of heroic vision was driven in part by wishful thinking. At least that would be Elster's view. Wishful thinking can be an extremely powerful and creative part of social movements. Wishful thinking would be an example of the unrealistic optimism kind of argument. But it may be that you have to be unrealistically optimistic in order to get anything done. I think a plausible argument can be made that in the absence of grand wishful thinking, even modest social democracy wouldn't have been possible. So the small improvements, which nevertheless make a big difference in people's lives, that have occurred through radical struggles over the past century or so, were able to achieve modest gains because people had unrealistic aspirations. There are folk sayings that capture, you know, that idea, you know, reaching for the stars. Of course, you can't actually reach the stars, but if you reach for the stars, you can achieve something. Wishful thinking, though, of course, can be destructive, too. That is, if wishful thinking completely dominates your beliefs, and you have no recognition that you have, you know, longings for aspirations that can interfere with your judgment about what's realistically possible, can lead you into disastrous circumstances where you believe, if only we repress the opposition now for a short time, then we can clear the decks and get on with building a more just and egalitarian and democratic world, where the adoption of those kinds of strategies reflects wishful thinking, that they won't have such damaging that won't have such damaging effects to the nature of the structures of power as to block the possibility of an emancipatory future. So wishful thinking, like adaptive preferences, can have positive and negative effects. Adaptive preferences can have very positive effects, you know, reducing your beliefs about what's good to what, in fact, you can practically achieve may reduce your levels of frustration and make for a more tranquil life. Resignation in the face of defeat may not be such a bad thing if it keeps you from living a bitter and angry life when your goals are thwarted. So adaptive preferences the left generally regards as a bad thing. I mean, I do too. You know, I think it's bad for poor people to give up and feel resigned to their fate rather than to struggle. But it's also true that there's some adaptive aspects of adaptive preferences, and life may be better being resigned to one's fate than to be constantly bitter about the injustices and oppressions to which one is subjected, and you can't realistically do anything about it. Just saying that there's psychological complexity to each of these. Mental bookkeeping is actually a really interesting problem, and one that has gotten a lot of play in discussions of political psychology recently. Mental bookkeeping refers to the ways in which your cognitive classifications of various phenomena shape your motivations. The best example in contemporary politics is the debate on abortion. Once the anti-abortion forces figured out that calling their position pro-life, and so calling it pro-life, that's a way of classifying the world. There's two kinds of positions in the world. There's pro-life and anti-life. And identifying pro-life with opposition to abortion and creating that connection linguistically, that's mental bookkeeping, it's a way of classifying the categories, affects people's emotions and their motivations. Pro-choice, then, became the response. So I think the history of the language around the abortion debate was, first it was just defending abortion rights. It was not initially called pro-choice. It was just the women's rights to an abortion. Pro-life then became the one after Roe v. Wade in the United States. Pro-life became the mental bookkeeping, framing of the debate, and then pro-choice became the response. Well, that's a really interesting bit of mental bookkeeping and framing. Pro-choice is a weaker language than pro-life. You know, everyone is pro-life. Choice seems kind of narcissistic, you know. Everybody's right to choose it. Jerry Cohen has a fantastic little skit, which at the retreat in December, I'm going to show you Jerry Cohen's stand-up comic routines. I have videos of them. He has this little routine called the German idea of freedom, which is it's very funny, but he talks about this, the stupidity of choice as an important part of life between bananas and apples. I mean, who cares, right? So choice has a kind of trivializing quality. Nevertheless, the right to choose was, I think, the strongest rhetorical response to pro-life. But unfortunately, in this particular debate, there's more emotional power, I think, around pro-life. That mental bookkeeping scheme triggers emotions more powerfully than does the right to choose. And I give a couple of other examples here. The social category child is an interesting one in terms of mental bookkeeping, because by, I think, universal belief, small children need the protection of mature adults.